This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Finally, a shaky roadmap towards sustainability in troubling times. I'm Alex, and this week we go for the transition movement, West Coast style. What started with Rob Hopkins in the village of Totnes, England, is evolving in North America. We'll hear from early adapters in Colorado, Los Angeles, and Vancouver. Our guests are Michael Brownlee from Boulder, Joanne Poirot from Village LA, and Vandy Savage from Vancouver. We'll top that off with speakers at a Village Vancouver meetup, Ann Pacey and Ross Moster. It's crammed full of ideas for your own action plan. If oil becomes expensive like gold or stops coming, if the climate shifts, if the economy falls apart, these neighborhoods are working now to keep going. Community building, transition towns, all coming your way next on Radio EcoShock. The transition movement has spread from the United Kingdom to North America, and Michael Brownlee is a gateway for many people discovering this new vision of living and community building. Brownlee co-founded Transition Colorado. Michael, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Glad to be here.
Michael, just to let listeners know what to expect, I'd like to suggest a game plan. Let's start with a brief explanation of what transition is. That can take hours, I know, but let's try for a few minutes. Then we'd like to hear from your seminal article in Transition Times, The Evolution of Transition in the U.S. A little history first, before we dive into the new proposals for deep transition. If we have time, I'd like to end up with stories from Transition Colorado, a few on-the-ground examples of what people are doing. So, for the many listeners who already know about climate change and peak oil, what is the transition movement?
Well, the transition movement is about preparing our communities for the local impacts of these global crises like climate change and fossil fuel depletion or peak oil and economic decline as well. Because what's happened over the last 60, 70 years especially is as the economy has become increasingly globalized, our communities have lost their capacities to meet their own essential needs locally. So the transition movement is about relocalization, finding ways to make it possible for our communities to regain those capacities again. And the movement started in the UK just over 4 years ago in Totnes, England, where Rob Hopkins, a longtime permaculture teacher, decided to see if he could create a community-wide process in that little town for relocalization. And he mapped out a process in his experience there, which other communities have begun to pick up around the world. And the movement has, much to his surprise, grown quite rapidly in maybe 15 or 16 different countries now. So it's spread, and one of the reasons that it's important is that it's the first thing that any of us have seen, I think, that give us a sense that there is a process, that there is a pathway that we can bring to our communities to move towards relocalization, to make the transition off of fossil fuel dependence and become much more resilient and self-reliant. So that, in a nutshell, is what the transition movement is about.
How did this British initiative appear in the U.S., and what existing institutions did it build on?
Well, it began in the U.S. because there were several of us, many communities in this country and others, that were attempting relocalization, although we were quite clear that we didn't know how to do it. Many of us had been inspired by Post Carbon Institute, founded by Julian Darley, who had begun this idea of a relocalization network. But by the time Rob Hopkins and his transition process came along, we were all pretty hungry for a methodology, a pathway towards relocalization. So we had been watching what he was doing over there, and I finally went over in, I guess it was early 2008, to see for myself if all the good rumors about transition were true. I went through a two-day transition training in Scotland and made my pilgrimage down to Totnes, England, to meet with Rob Hopkins and some of the other leaders there, and saw what was happening in the UK, was very excited and inspired by it, and felt that this had to come to the United States. So I and several other people in the U.S. here began organizing, reshaping our relocalization work around transition. And our organization here in Boulder, Colorado, actually became the very first officially recognized transition initiative in North America. And it's spread since that time, of course. There are now, I think, 79 officially recognized transition initiatives in the U.S. And we don't know how many, but probably another couple hundred that are what the movement likes to call mullers, those who are considering utilizing the transition process in their communities.
Could you just name some of the larger or more advanced places in the U.S. that are taking on this transition challenge?
Let's see. Transition Sandpoint, Idaho is maybe the farthest along of the new crop of transition initiatives. They did their Great Unleashing Big Public event in November of 2008, and they're now working on their Energy Descent Action Plan for their community. So they seem to be very strong, but it's a small community of about 8,000 people, much like Totnes. On the other end of the spectrum is, believe it or not, Transition Los Angeles, which is addressing not just the city of L.A., but the whole L.A. basin of, you know, 14 million people or so. It's a huge challenge, but there are a number of very, very committed people there who are taking the lead and inspiring neighborhoods and smaller communities in the L.A. area to join together in this transition process. So those are the ends of the scale, and then we see many other cities in between. Ann Arbor is strong. Bloomington, Indiana is strong. Many other communities across the country. There's a new initiative that's really strong showing up down in Sarasota, Florida. We're glad to see the Southeast starting to move in this direction. Those are some of the ones that are doing well out there.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, here with Michael Brownlee, the co-founder of Transition Colorado. Michael, why do you think the transition movement, as envisaged by Rob Hopkins and others in the UK, might have to be modified to work in America?
Well, I think we're discovering, as we attempt to enroll communities in the transition model or the transition process, that the U.S. is different. Our culture is different. Our history is different. Our mindset is different here. Some of the aspects of transition that were created in the U.K. need to be adapted more here. For instance, the transition work as it's defined by Rob Hopkins in the Transition Handbook speaks really to peak oil and climate change as the primary challenges, does not mention the economic situation that we're facing. And I think that we have felt that more painfully here in the U.S. than they have in the U.K. Until fairly recently. So we have felt from early on that we had to include that in our presentation, help people to understand what's happening with the economy and the kind of impact that that might have on their communities and their own lives. There are other cultural differences that I think are important. For instance, in the UK, this is just my observation, and I'm sure other people may see this differently, but I sensed when I was over there a greater sense of community than we have in this country. You know, my observation about the U.S. has been for a long time that community has, you know, it's maybe our scarcest and most endangered resource here. And communities have been kind of hollowed out by economic globalization, and so our culture has been experiencing a kind of silo effect. So people are not accustomed to working together and collaborating collaborating and cooperating and co-creating in the form of a movement. You know, they're much more focused on individual efforts, individual lifestyles. So it's harder to catalyze a grassroots movement here in this country, it seems, than it is in the UK. We also noticed in the UK that there is a greater curiosity about the facts, the realities of fossil fuel depletion, the realities of climate change. You know, when I saw public presentations over there, people had many, many questions, penetrating, in-depth questions. In this country, it seems like we're maybe a little less interested in the facts. We're much more interested in opinions. So that makes it difficult to present some of these ideas. So those are just a few of the things that I think compel us to adapt the transition model to our own culture. And in fact, I think that it has to be adapted to every community, because every community is unique. It has its own unique challenges. And while there are principles and guidelines in transition that are certainly applicable anywhere, just as in permaculture, for instance, how transition is implemented in a community will vary from community to community. There's one other thing that happens here sometimes in the United States, and that is if something is invented across the ocean, we try to implement it exactly as it is. You know, Rob Hopkins is obviously brilliant. He's a great leader, and the movement is growing, so we'll do it just like they did. And we discover, oh, it doesn't work that way. We need to take greater responsibility for adapting and evolving this transition process ourselves, and I think that that's true across the movement.
I have to agree. You know, I was at a meeting of Village Vancouver, and they're even looking at the differences between different parts of the city and how they would adapt, and everybody has to come up with their own plan. We've got a bunch of tools on the bench, but you've got to pick out what really works where you are. The other thing I was thinking about as I was thinking about this interview is just fast-moving events right now in the Middle East. We have a situation in Egypt where, we presume with the transition movement there's going to be a lot of time to make this transition, but within a week in Egypt, the police disappeared, the banks are closed, the ATMs are empty, a lot of problems in a short period of time. We hope that doesn't happen here, but I wonder, you know, how can the transition movement take into account the possibility of a sudden change?
Well, I think that that's one of the tensions between some of the leaders of the transition movement in this country and those in the UK. I think that we clearly have a greater sense of urgency here than they do there. I think that's partly a cultural phenomenon, but in any case, we feel that it's crucial to look at the short-term potential for some of these kinds of problems. The transition process, as it's been defined, takes a while to implement. I mean, in Totnes, England, where this all began, they just, I think, early last year finally published their Energy Descent Action Plan, and it took them nearly 4 years to get to that point, and they're just at the beginning stages of attempting to implement that plan. And so other communities are looking at this and seeing, gosh, it took them that long. It looks like it might take even longer here. Do we have that much time? And so people like Richard Heinberg have been pleading for transition initiatives to say, of course, we need to be looking at the long-term planning here, but we also need to develop scenarios for the short term as well, because we could see dramatic price spikes in oil, or even temporary outages, shortages in oil. We could see the rising global food crisis begin to hit home in parts of this country. And in fact, that's beginning to happen in some places, especially to those who don't have a high level of income. There are other things that certainly could happen, weather events, terrorism events, but we're not well prepared to be resilient to be able to withstand whatever shocks may come in the short term. So we increasingly are encouraging people to develop short-term contingency plans as well as the longer-term planning process. And where that really comes home, I think, for a lot of people is in their own personal preparation. I mean, doing the things that Chris Martinson, for instance, is recommending, that we all have a reasonable supply of food and water and other essentials in case of emergency, so that if something significant happens in the short term, we're not completely vulnerable, but we'll actually be in a position where we can assist in our communities.
Yeah, I'm taking some of those steps myself. I do agree with the Mormons about having a year's worth of food if you can, and I think I have that much, but probably I would just end up feeding most of my neighbors with it, and I've gotten to know my neighbors, and I think that's another really important step in the short-term planning. Would you agree?
I absolutely agree. I think that that's wonderful. Certainly the model that we have seen from the Mormons and a few others is very relevant to us now. They've learned a lot about how to prepare for challenging times, and I think many of us need to take those lessons to heart, not only on an individual level, but also at a community level. So we're seeing, for instance, a greater interest in building on the Mormon model of community canneries, for instance. I think that this will be really essential in the future, that we localize food processing, because we're going to need to be able to eat locally year-round. And without that kind of food processing and storage, we're not going to be able to do that. So there is a movement underway to develop that kind of infrastructure that can help us be resilient.
And it can also save you money in tough economic times. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is transition teacher Michael Brownlee. Well, Michael, you have called for something called deep transition. Talk to us about this and take a few minutes to explain what you mean by that.
Sure. Let me just say that where this has emerged for us is out of the work of doing training for transition leaders. The other co-founder of Transition Colorado, Lynette Marie Hanthorne, and I are certified trainers in the Transition Network, and we have been doing these trainings, 2 and 3 day trainings around the country. And as we've been working with this and working with our own initiative and others in Colorado and other initiatives across the country, we're seeing, well, first of all, you can't expect people to learn how to relocalize a community over a 2 day workshop. This is an enormous challenge that we're all facing in relocalizing our communities. And I'm now talking about those who are already either leaders or part of an initiating group in a transition initiative, or those who want to be. I'm not just talking about the general public here. But for those people who find themselves deeply called to this work of catalyzing relocalization and transition in their communities, they need tools and perspectives and processes and experiences that will support them in this work. So just getting people inspired and excited and somewhat informed is not adequate. We feel that these people need much, much more. There are other tools and processes besides what's being currently offered in the transition movement that we think are going to be increasingly essential for those leaders. And so deep transition is about bringing in some of those other processes and perspectives and tools and making them available to transition leaders. And that includes things like the perspective of new cosmology or the universe story first presented by Thomas Berry and Brian Swim, which is a science-based understanding of the process of evolution of the universe itself, which allows us to really connect to the underlying processes of life. And this gives us really important clues to how we can move in our communities to catalyze what is essentially transition or relocalization is essentially an evolutionary process. You know, we're learning we can't make transition happen in our communities. We can only be catalysts for transition. How do we learn that? So We bring in some other perspectives like spiral dynamics. It gives us tools for understanding different people's consciousness as they're being confronted by these challenges and these opportunities, and how we can help them to respond. So this helps us a lot in trying to build a grassroots movement, understanding where people are so that we're not creating something that's divisive in our communities. There are many other pieces to it. An aspect of it, I would say, is what we think of as the inner transition work, or sometimes called heart and soul. This is understanding that, you know, we all have been deeply affected by what I will call the industrial growth society. It is a mindset, it is a paradigm that has actually created the predicament that we all find ourselves in collectively today. And because of that paradigm, we all to a degree have become separated from nature, disconnected from natural processes of life. We have been disconnected from each other. We have been disconnected from the deeper aspect of our own souls, even. So for this work to be truly resilient, truly sustainable, we feel that these things need to become reconnected. So a lot of the work in deep transition is about that and making that possible. You know, some people speak of the importance of decolonizing our minds from the industrial growth society, and that's a process that we're all going through. We're all waking up. We're all learning what the greater realities are that we're living in. So maybe I'll stop there and just say that deep transition is an exploration of what we most need to know and understand and experience in order to be what we think of as evolutionary catalysts in this time to help heal and regenerate our communities.
Getting our feet back on the ground, Michael, tell us what is happening in Colorado.
Well, in Transition Colorado, our focus here is, our transition work primarily is focused on revitalizing the local food and farming system. We feel that food is the area where we are most vulnerable because we're so dependent on external resources. In Boulder County, for instance, we spend $700 million a year on food. Less than 1% of that is for locally produced food. So it's radically out of balance, which makes us very vulnerable and economically very weak. So we're working to rebuild food and farming here through awareness-raising campaigns, through investment funds, through Eat Local Week, through an Eat Local resource guide and directory, a magazine that we publish here. Lots of events, lots of reskilling, getting people involved in gardening and raising chickens and bees and goats and being responsible for raising some of their own food, learning those fundamental life skills that were kind of taken for granted by our parents and great-grandparents, but somehow we didn't inherit. So that's the primary focus for us. And part of it is to bring in the awareness that rebuilding our food and farming system here may be the most important thing that we can do in terms of economic development locally, in terms of contributing to reducing our greenhouse gas emissions and contributing to the health of our children and the health of our communities. And this is happening for many transition initiatives. This has become a major focus for our work here. So that's just one aspect.
If people want to find out more, what resources do you recommend?
The transitionus.org is the national organization, and that will connect you in with a lot that's happening in transition across the country, around the world. Rob Hopkins' blog is transitionculture.org, daily blog, 5 days a week, really excellent. Our website is transitioncolorado.org, and there is also a social networking site for the state called transitioncolorado.ning, ning.com.
Well, I'll toss all those links into my blog for this show at ecoshock.info. Our guest on Radio EcoShock is Michael Brownlee. He's a co-founder of Transition Colorado, a transition speaker, writer, and trainer. Michael, I really appreciate talking with you.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, Alex. It's great to talk with you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much for listening. This is Alex for Radio EcoShock. Last year, I started noticing a big change in the people who attended speeches and meetings about former doomer subjects like climate change and peak oil. The crowd used to be mostly older white guys, often with beards. Lately, women are starting to outnumber the men. Here comes another one, a spark plug organizer and people connector, Vandy Savage from Vancouver. Vandy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
You know, I kind of woke up to the gender change at last fall's talk by Kathy McMahon, the peak oil shrink, and incidentally, my recording of Kathy's speech has been downloaded by thousands of people. Why are so many women showing up now?
Well, I think there has been a dramatic shift in what women are doing with their time after their children have mostly grown up. As you know, when we're raising kids and working full-time, that's just about all we can fit into our lives, and most of our activism is around the actual raising and of our children, perhaps volunteering at the schools or volunteering for after-school programs or whatever. But once our kids are adults, or at least in high school, many of us then take our what would be called spare time and turn it toward political activism.
Well, just recently I attended a Village Vancouver meetup, kind of an update on the transition movement here. Women outnumbered men 2-1. Is it partly the practical solutions being offered?
I think that's part of it. I think that women also, the women that you are seeing, grew up in a time when they have been given free rein to be who we want to be. Really, our mothers did not have that social okay to do this. And I do think practical solutions, women, if anything, are pragmatic. Well, how can we actually do that at home, and how do we benefit our communities?
So do you think women see these impending crises differently? Do they feel differently about the bad news that's rolling in?
Yes, I think we absolutely do. At one point, you and I were talking about fight or flight, and the idea that when things get really tough, you either fight your enemy or you run away. And there was a study done at UCLA, about 10 years ago now, where several women sociologists studied what women's response to danger is, and it's not fight or flight at all. In fact, it's community building. The first thing a woman does is say, okay, where are my kids and my husband, my family? Are we safe? Let's gather together. And the second thing they do is they get with other women and basically form a community and make a group decision about what to do. It's not an individual fight or flight. And I think that's what we are now doing for the danger of, you know, global warming and overshoot, overpopulation. We are exhibiting that, gathering around and forming community and saying, okay, collectively, what are we going to do?
But isn't there a danger that women will end up back in the gardens and in the kitchens while men run the New Age movements and talk endlessly about what it all means? That's happened before in some back-to-the-land movements. There's a danger we could go backwards.
I am deeply worried about that. When I read Howard Kunstler, I get very concerned because I think there is a danger because we are not fully equal in any society in the world. And so, of course, when things get tough, often people get more conservative and revert to old social systems. And I am worried about that.
What can we do about it?
Well, in my view, the most powerful thing we can do is educate women. The more educated we become, the more personal power we have. And when we have that personal power to make decisions for ourselves and economic power to earn a living and not be somebody's shadow, then we are more willing to take risks and to do things for ourselves. And I think that's the key thing for everything, for world peace, for overpopulation, for everything is education and support of women.
Well, you know, I've only just met you a couple of times, but I was really intrigued by your discussion of your relationship with nature. Can you tell us some of the things that you're personally involved in?
Well, I am very much tied into nature because, perhaps, because I grew up camping as a kid. So for me, what I like to do in my spare time is I like to backpack, I garden, I'm a big swimmer. Anything to do with water, I still surf. I take the ferry over to Tofino. I have a whole collection of wetsuits. I learned to scuba dive last summer. For me, being in nature, looking at the stars at night, first of all, it's humbling, and you realize how small and insignificant you are compared to the universe. But secondly, it also makes you understand, or at least it makes me understand, that I am merely one aspect of nature. I am no different than any animal on this planet. And in fact, I don't eat animals for that very reason.
You know, you bring up the stars. We can't see them in the city, and I almost think it's a plot to keep us all involved in our own little network of humans in the hive. You know, wouldn't it be a different world if we could always see the stars as most humans do?
I agree, Alex. I think that the last 100 years of electric lights, not only have they really wreaked havoc on the nocturnal creatures of our planet who need to navigate by the stars and the moon, but for us as human beings, because we rarely see the night skies, I think we don't understand that we are this little ball spinning around at the edge of a galaxy, which is one of billions of galaxies in our universe.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are covering the West Coast appearance of the Transition Movement. Joanne Poirot co-founded a community group that became Transition Los Angeles. She continues as part of that core team while participating in her local Westchester neighborhood of L.A. Joanne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Los Angeles is so huge, 10 million people, it seems impossible to imagine anything sustainable developing there. Can you give us some concrete examples of what is happening in these early days of transition in L.A.?
Well, at the current moment, we have from 6 to 9 local groups happening. They're all working along the lines of the transition movement internationally, and they put on quite a panorama of events, everything from alternative health fairs to building community gardens to looking at water issues to creating time banks. A wide variety of awareness-raising movies and events. A lot of the things that you see in other transition projects around the world.
And as I understand it, according to the website, there's a ladder of self-organizing units that you have been calling pods, although that may be in transition too. What are pods and how is that developing?
Pods was one of our early names for what would we call these local subgroups within Los Angeles. Realize that L.A. is a vast basin geographically with just wall-to-wall people here, and we were trying to figure out how to use the localization model that had come out of small towns in England and adapt it to this massive geography. And at first we were talking about pods being the local groups within Los Angeles, but at this point we tend to use just the terminology of local groups. And at the current moment, they're in all kinds of stages of formation, from very active and groups that have events multiple times a month to some that just meet once a month and are a small circle of people.
Some of the things that I'm seeing there remind me of what's happening here in Vancouver. We find people create new community, sometimes based on neighborhoods and who's right around you, but also through common interests. For example, we have gays and lesbians organizing for sustainability. What sort of interest groups have you seen?
Well, one of the things that we early on realized was that people in LA are very accustomed to driving to get to things. And that if we were to go to a pure localization model, that it didn't necessarily work for the way people think or identify. So we started really with models of belonging, like where did people feel they fit in? Where did they feel a sense of community already? So some of our early centers were a yoga center, a community garden, Episcopal Church, places that people already felt a sense of connection where they would return to find that sense of a circle of like-minded people with whom to explore these ideas.
And then the local groups communicate through the Transition Los Angeles Hub. Can you describe how the hub works?
Well, the hub's very simple. It's really a opportunity for the leaders to get together and to discuss leadership issues. When you're leading a transition group or any community group, you come up against those knotty issues of, you know, how do you deal with this conflict or this schedule issue, or is this a good route, or we're having difficulties with, you know, the following items, and you need someone to bounce those ideas off of, and it's really helpful to have fellow leaders who are working, you know, alongside you and really can understand that and say, hey, we've been there, we did that, and this is what we tried.
And how does all that relate to Transition US?
We communicate with Transition US. We're also, when people connect with Transition US and are looking for people in Los Angeles, they find us through the network. At the same time, we do a lot of outreach and answering questions like this interview, like interviews we do, to help other areas understand about the transition movement, the basic premises of it, how people are approaching things. So we're always available to help people get started.
You mentioned community gardens, and it's a great place to grow things, but I do remember just a few years ago on YouTube watching the video of protests of a large community garden that was taken down. I don't know whether it was the city or a private developer. Have a lot more new community gardens sprung up, and how can we handle this problem of ownership of the land itself?
Well, in my own neighborhood, we're building a new community garden this year, and certainly I think that the awareness in the last 3 to 5 years has highlighted the need for increased numbers of places for people to grow food. So that certainly helps as far as getting through the red tape and making these community gardens come into existence.
Is there any support or understanding from City Hall?
Certainly. We're working with the mayor's office right now. We're working with LAUSD. That's the massive school district here.
I lived in L.A. in the Silver Lake area quite a few years back, and I've returned several times in recent years. One obvious change is a different kind of transition, the change to Spanish speakers in many neighborhoods. Is there a Latino transition movement?
Not yet, but there's always time. We've really only been in existence as Transition Los Angeles for a bare 2 years, and in that time, we've grown from just a single group that had an idea and a connection to this international movement to going on 9 active local groups offering events and gatherings every single month. So any day now we will hear from people who can speak Spanish. I can't speak Spanish myself, otherwise I'd be out there starting it.
Hablo poco. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Our guest is Joanne Poirot, one of the organizers of Transition Los Angeles. Joanne, one problem I did have looking at the website, it describes peak oil and climate change as motivators, but it didn't seem to talk about the economic crash, and that seems odd, considering the big hole that used to be California real estate, all the foreclosures, the unemployment, you know the scene. Why not use that to promote self-sufficiency and sustainability in hard times?
Well, actually, that is highlighted on our Transition Los Angeles level website. I think that part of that in the national organization is somewhat of a question of whether they're seeing it coming out of England or not, where this movement started. I'm working myself on a paper right now about the economics and transition movement, so it certainly is very much a part of what's going on here in Los Angeles. Southern California experienced some of the worst of that real estate crash, so it's definitely present in our local populace. And you know, as with anything transition, things are very localized. It's really going to be driven by the issues that people in the local geography are experiencing and grappling with.
So you see West Coast Americans understanding the transition movement differently than the original organizers in Britain?
I see every single local organization understanding it ever so slightly differently because they have different sets of circumstances that they're dealing with. For instance, when the materials came out of England, we laughed at them here in LA because they never mentioned water. Here in Los Angeles, that's a huge issue as far as sustainability, and obviously it's not a problem in England.
What do you think the biggest problems are we still have to solve to make the transition movement go mainstream?
I think one of the biggest problems is courage, that people are beginning to realize at this time that things aren't as they thought they were, particularly with regards to the economic situation. And although people see that things are changed or changing, it takes a tremendous amount of courage to put your money where your mouth is, to actually make those huge transformative adjustments in your everyday lifestyle, and perhaps even in the lifestyles of your children and your expectations for the future. That takes a lot of courage and confidence in your ideas. And as we grow greater numbers of people who are willing to do that, I think that this whole wave of change, Joanna Macy calls it the Great Turning. I think that a lot of that will change a whole lot faster the more people start to come on board, because people feel that they have company in that journey.
Well, and two, another problem I think is that the mainstream media are telling us that things are fine. We're in the recovery. It's all going well. And as long as people can believe in that daydream, they're going to keep hanging on, commuting 1,000 miles to work and going shopping at the big chain stores. So in a way, we sort of need a couple more shocks, I think, to wake people up.
I'm enjoying a billboard that is near my home, and I pass it several times a week, and it says, "The recession is over? ? Would somebody tell my portfolio?" And I think that that really reflects a lot of people's feeling is, although we've got the media saying this, people aren't feeling it. There's a lot of people around me who are still unemployed. There's a lot of people around me who are now underemployed than they were before this whole thing started. And a lot of the materials that I read indicate that this is only the first of it. We have a whole lot more to come. And given that, it really demands that we be thinking in new and different ways. And the transition movement's concepts of self-sufficiency and local resilience feed right into the same answers that we come up with as far as how to cope with an economic issue.
Do you have new projects you want to tell us about?
I think that a lot of our projects here in Los Angeles thus far have been getting new local groups started. That's been a huge emphasis over the last 2 years. But as we start to have more established groups, we're starting to see specialization in those groups where, for instance, in Transition Mar Vista, we have a lot of people interested in alternative health. They now have a community wellness forum once every 2 weeks that brings together local practitioners. We have time banks sprouting up in Whittier and San Fernando Valley, new efforts to create those kind of concepts in alternative economics. We have, I previously mentioned, the new garden in Westchester, but there are many local gardens and a whole change in consciousness about local food and seeing how much can be grown here in Los Angeles. We have a year-round growing season, and so there's really no reason we shouldn't be growing food instead of grass.
Do you have a couple of web links you'd like to give for our listeners?
Well, anyone wants to find out about Transition Los Angeles, we're at transitionla.org, and you can find just about everything on there about us.
We could spend an hour on this, and I'd like to sometime, but that's our brief report from Los Angeles for this week. My thanks to you, Joanne Poirot, for sharing your time and energy.
Thanks for having me on your show.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. How can the great city of Vancouver regroup into intimate and sustainable neighborhoods? Let's find out what is going on in this greening city on the west coast of Canada. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In January 2011, I recorded two introductory speakers at a meetup for Village Vancouver. Early founders Ann Pacey and Ross Moster address a group of 35 people around the big table with plates of homemade potluck food on the go.
Hi, I'm Ann. I'm member of the core group and also one of the conveners, co-conveners for the Dunbar Village. I've been involved with Village Vancouver for about 2 years, and that kind of grew out of the fact that 2004 I started studying climate change, and then I started studying peak oil, and I kind of scared myself to death. And so when I moved to, I heard about transition really right after it got started in 2007, but I was living in Peru, so there really wasn't much activity going on. So when I came to Vancouver, I searched out Ross and have gotten involved. And for me, it's really, you know, the only, it's a substantial way of moving forward to address the issues that we all face together.
And I'm Ross, and I'm the convener for Village Vancouver, so been involved since the beginning. And my interest, since I kind of am the person that is always bugging people to get involved and do stuff, my interests are like the whole ball of wax, basically. But my particular interest is around food. I'm a member of the Vancouver Food Policy Council, and then also around other stuff. I'm on the Carfree board, but really just kind of everything.
Yeah, we put together this presentation as kind of a general introduction to what Village Vancouver is for an audience that may not necessarily be exposed to it. And before I get started, just how many of you guys have heard about peak oil before? And how many of you kind of consider that you have a fairly deep understanding of what the consequences of peak oil are? Okay, great. Because I really have a tendency to go over the top. I mean, I've been spending the last 6 years, I probably put in 8-10 hours a week reading about this stuff. So, I mean, my husband kind of looks at me like, oh, there you are again. You're the doomer and the gloomer. We're not going to go there tonight. But I think it is important that we, as Rob said, I mean, transition was really evolved around the whole question of this transition that we've got to make in how we energize our societies, both from the point of view that we are, in fact, running out of easily accessible, cheap oil, which is what our societies were built upon. And the other side of it is that the waste that's produced by burning that energy has created these horrendous consequences, which is climate change, which we're actually facing, too. So the question is, you know, which one gets us first, you know, climate change or peak oil? Yeah, that's basically what we want. Just briefly cover what is peak oil, what is climate change, and what is Village Vancouver doing in the context of that? What are we doing here locally? And then what can I do as an individual? Village Vancouver was officially granted transition status in December of last year. So we have been an official part of the transition network since 2009. We were set up to meet those two basic challenges of climate change and peak oil. And what that means in terms of transition, it means going from a city where we're tremendously dependent upon energy, fossil fuel energy, to one that is much more resilient to interruptions in that supply. So we find other ways to fuel ourselves. So the three issues then, just very briefly, climate change, and I'm not using global warming because where you are depends very much on how it actually is. And there are a number of people who actually might think we're flipping into a climate freeze. I mean, we're actually due for an ice age as opposed to heating up. But who knows how it's going to end up? Our models really don't tell us that much. But what we do know is we know we're going from a very stable period of time to an unstable period of time. And that's, I mean, scientists tend to be really kind of, you know, 99%, 95%. But I mean, frankly, we all pretty much know that this is caused by anthropogenic forcing. And the second point is peak oil. And peak oil, a lot of people are confused about this, and I know I'm preaching to or talking to people who already know about this. It's not when we run out. It's actually when we can't produce more. And Rob made that video in 2009. Actually, this year, the International Energy Agency has just admitted that we hit a peak in conventional oil back in 2006. So the international agency responsible for advising international governments or governments around the world has admitted to the fact that we know we have peaked in our conventional oil, and it's been 4 years now, almost 5 years now. So the stuff that's making up that difference in our growth is not conventional. It's the more expensive, the much more expensive stuff, the much lower density energy. Ethanol, shale, I mean, yeah. natural gas, liquids from natural gas, all of that stuff is making up the difference. But the cheap, easy to pump stuff is basically hit a peak, and they're now projecting it's going to be declining at 9% a year. So we're right there. We're right where we're really going to start to see these effects happening. 2008 was just a preview of it. And a lot of people think 2011, 2012 is going to get pretty nasty out there. those are both occurring in the overall context. And I know somebody mentioned it about our overconsumption in the fact that we have exceeded the planet's capacity to provide for us, both in terms of resources as well as terms of waste sinks. So we've pushed the planet to its limits. So peak oil and gas, I mean, this is one of the classic curves. It just kind of shows, I mean, this is, you know, right around where we are right now, and you know, things are starting to decline. We've probably peaked already overall globally in terms of all energy sources, certainly in terms of conventional. But meanwhile, the demand for energy is increasing, particularly with regard to China and India, which creates an interesting geopolitical context, shifting context. And there's just no way we've got other sources of energy to fill that gap. So we're really hitting a limit. Our energy that provides our society with the ability to be as complex as it is not sufficient to maintain that complexity. So we're going to start seeing a de-complexing, simplifying of our economy. I talk with my hands. I lived in Latin America for too long. Yeah, so what are the consequences of peak oil? And I think this is something that people really don't get an idea. They don't really have a very clear idea of how fundamental oil is to every aspect of our society and what happens when oil starts to go up. I mean, we saw the effects to a certain extent in 2008, although most of the media were laying the blame on speculation. The peak oil group in general thinks it was an initial effect of that peaking, where it's a plateau, dropping down, economic recession, demand drops, so the price drops. So those kinds of fluctuations we're going to be seeing. It's not just a steady uphill climb. But that increase in price of oil really feeds into across the board. It goes into food. Food right now is at an all-time high. Many of the food commodities are back above the 2008 levels. Again, peak oil people think it has a very direct impact on economic growth, and the mainstream economists tend to put that down. They don't think it's so clearly important, but it does, in fact, affect the dynamics, cost of everything that we're doing. Everything that is produced by oil becomes expensive and scarce, and that includes all the food. I mean, one of the things, I mean, if we talk a lot about food here, right now our food is produced by petroleum, and I think a lot of you already know that. I mean, anywhere from 7 to 10 calories of oil energy is required to produce 1 calorie of food that we consume. That's from the tilling of the land, to the planting, to the fertilizers, to the pesticides, to the harvesting, to the transport, to the processing facilities, to the processing, to the packaging, to the distribution, to then getting into the consumer's home. All of that requires a huge amount of oil as an input. So our agricultural system is very vulnerable right now to oil prices. It's vulnerable in a number of other monoculture. I mean, you can think of a lot of other ways it's as vulnerable, but oil is definitely one of the key factors that's going to have a tremendous impact on our ability to feed ourselves. I mean, I think everybody also is aware of the fact that we've got about 3 days of supply of food in our supermarkets. I mean, they do just-in-time delivery, so we basically have no ability to weather more than just about 3 days, 5 days of shutdown. If there's any reason at all we can't truck food in, what's going to happen here? I mean, that's the kind of thinking that somebody should be going through. I mean, we don't have the ability to maintain our population right now. Our food shed for Vancouver doesn't come close to feeding us. And globalization. Globalization was built on sheep transport. So as oil goes up, globalization starts to unravel. So it's actually a really tremendously important issue that we should all understand. And I don't think I'm going to say anything more about it because I think I've gotten gloomy and doomy enough.
You're listening to part of a meetup of Village Vancouver, starting with Ann Pacey. This is Radio EcoShock. Next up, Ross Moster.
Yeah, I'll try and cheer everybody up. So Village Vancouver, we started about almost 3 years ago, and we weren't initially part of the transition movement. We hadn't actually heard of it, but then we started noticing as we went along that what we were doing was the same thing as transition towns, so we decided to hook up and make it official. There's about 18 different official transition towns in Canada. I think we're the 9th or 10th, although in terms of age, if we had applied originally, we would have been the 1st or 2nd. I'm kind of known for giving different descriptions of Village Vancouver every time, but I keep trying to simplify it, and I think the one that I like the best, and there's a couple of variations, and what it is I like to say Village Vancouver is like real life, only more sustainable, or Village Vancouver is like real life, only more resilient. And what that means is anything is within our purview, because really what we're trying to do is create the capacity to shift the paradigm from this totally unsustainable society where we're rapidly going down the tubes to one where we're resilient. And resilient, of course, is the ability of something to absorb shocks and bounce back and keep going. So it's really a simple concept what we're trying to do. As we went around the room, you know, we kind of learned, and I knew this was going to happen, there's like a fantastic amount of resources. And I didn't live in Latin America, but I use my hands anyway. We just have a fantastic amount of resources right within our communities, within our neighborhoods, on our blocks. But we tend not to know our neighbors, so we don't utilize those resources. And it's a tremendous waste. And we're sitting there, we're kind of looking out for government to solve our problems, or for experts, and we're always looking the distance. But we really have a lot of the answers to create this really, even in the face of all these problems, to create this really abundant type of existence that's celebratory, that's fun, that meets our needs. But it just happens to be an existence that uses a lot less energy because we're going to be doing things differently. So that's what Village Vancouver is about. It's about connecting people in community, taking advantage by working collaboratively of using those resources. So when, for instance, we're starting Seed Collective, so Alexis put up a thing on the Seed Savers page, anybody interested in Strathcona and starting a Seed Collective, and a bunch of people responded. And that's really how simple it is. It's getting together, being a little intentional about creating this, meeting other people with similar interests, because another part of Village Vancouver, it's not like, oh, you should be doing this or you should be doing that. It's like, what are you interested in? So if you like to repair bicycles, we're not going to send you a note saying, you're supposed to be gardening, what's wrong with you? You know, we're going to say, okay, let's hook you up with other people that like to repair bicycles. If you want to garden, we want to, you know, hook you up with those people. So that's the whole idea. We have no budget, okay? So we put on like 100 workshops a year. People give us space, you know, we pay the presenters and maybe they give us a donation or something. But we do all this without money because we believe that it's not important. I mean, it's not that we're adverse to money, but it's like we don't want to wait for a grant to come to go out and do something, because what happens if it doesn't come? Do we stop? You know, it's like we're our own best resources, so we just go out and do it. And that's the whole idea. And it's totally people power driven. So what we like to do is we like to encourage you to just get involved in the basis of your interest. And we do that through our neighborhood villages. We have a number of villages. You'll hear about one of them tonight. We have projects, we have working groups, we have networks, and that's kind of basically what it is. Very, very simple idea. It's kind of rediscovering, like the name of the film that we're going to show you a segment from, is rediscovering the power of community. So, well, a lot of what we do, we found the website, which has only been up for a year, and we've got like we're getting close to 1,000 members now. You can join a village there. You can join one of the networks, and then you meet other people. The website's just a portal. I mean, if you just stay on the website and don't do anything else, then it's, you know, la-di-da. But the idea is like you go, okay, I'm in Strathcona, so who else is in Strathcona Village? Oh, they're in there, and they're having a seed-saving meeting, or they're having a potluck. I think I'll go to that. And I'll talk to people and find out who's interested in gardening or who's interested in this and that. And that's kind of where it all starts. And we've had pretty amazing results from there because, you know, you start meeting people and you start figuring out, you know, finding out what they're interested in. And
I think educating yourself, too, on an ongoing basis. And there's an amazing amount of information out on the web. And there's really positive stuff. And there's some that, you know, you just kind of want to slash your wrists afterwards. And I stay away from that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, so we freak out because these are pretty bad. I mean, these are horrible problems we're facing. But the question is, what do we do in response to them? Do we slit our wrists or do we make a positive response and do something about it? And that's
doing it in community. And I think that's the key to the whole idea of the transition town.
There's a part of this that nobody knows. We're inventing the, you know, as we go along because nobody's ever done this before. And there's a saying, we don't even know if this is going to work or not. You know, it's kind of like this big experiment. We have Village Vancouver, we have a steering committee, and then we have like, you know, we have different working groups and networks within Village Vancouver. So those are kind of communities of interest. And within those groups, there might be projects. And then we also have neighborhood villages, which are geographic communities. And the idea is really, there's no hierarchy. It's like this flat thing. So villages, there are people in villages that contribute to the working groups and to the steering committee. People in the steering committee are part of villages. And so it's this kind of helping each other this way rather than something like this. And we'll see how it turns out. But so far, so good.
That was part of a Village Vancouver meetup. The room was filled with energy and people connecting. Use these ideas to start your own neighborhood transition group. Find out more at villagevancouver.ca. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.